Sup, home slice.
What a way to start it.
Yeah, I gotta unbutton my pants.
Not much, dog.
I had sushi for lunch and now I'm too full for these pants.
I wish I had sushi for lunch. I didn't have anything for lunch. I had a slice of cheddar cheese for lunch.
I didn't have anything until about an hour ago, because I went to my pole class this morning and I got told.
Yeah, I imagine that's not the best thing to do on a full stomach.
Yeah, but I could have had like a yogurt or something.
Yeah,
I just didn't eat like an idiot. But I did get the okay to go ahead and start the beginner 2 classes, so I'm feeling pretty good about that. Then I came home and I tried on some jeans that I ordered once that didn't fit me when I bought them, but then I didn't return them because I was lazy, and they fit now, so look at that.
Nice
progress. What's happening?
Oh, I was trying to pop the video out, and it was just kept popping out a blank box, and I'm like, that's not helpful. Okay.
Oh, well, yeah. What's up with you?
Not a whole lot, really. Just, you know, dream stuff. Oh, I'm trying to do... So there's a YouTuber that, you know, it's PewDiePie, so like a ton of people know who he is. I'm not particularly a big fan of his, but he's
Isn't he
doing...
like a racist piece of shit?
There's been issues in the past, but it's like one of those things where it's like been like 15 years ago or something at this point, or like 10 years ago. So it's like, you know, and a lot of
are
it
we
was
going
like,
to let people grow, or are we going to just keep them accountable for the thing they did 15 years ago?
Punish them forever.
Yeah.
But he seems like he's mellowed out a lot. Like, got married, had a kid. Like, he seems a lot more mellow now than he used to be. I mean, just got older too. Like, he's our age. And, but he started this 100-day art challenge where he is drawing, like, doing an image every day by hand, going from having no, like, real rough cartoony, like, stick figure-y faces kind of thing. And now he's, like, at day 67 or something, and he's, like, putting together, like, actually pretty decent drawings and art. And so a lot of people are using it as a point of argument against AI, saying, like, you're saying that you can't do this. Well, like, here's this guy who's taking an hour out of his day to hone a skill. And look at how far he's come with just an hour a day. And no lessons, no expensive equipment. He's not doing it on a tablet. Like, he's learning by hand like almost every other artist does. And so it's been interesting to see people talking about it on Twitter and stuff, and just seeing like how it's really impressive. And it kind of helped me realize how far I am from when I first started drawing and everything too. And, you know, because anybody who's an artist or a creative out there, you know, you're your own worst enemy when it comes to anything creative that you're doing.
I don't know what you mean. I've never experienced that in my life.
Your stuff is never good. It's always wrong. The proportions are always bad. And someone else is always better than you. And, like, I mean,
that's not true.
Yeah. And I was like, while that's not incorrect, you know, it's easy to just want to throw whatever the thing you're trying to learn is down and say, well, I'll never be good at it. And so I am participating in my own. I'm gonna see if I can stick through it, to do a 100-day art challenge on my tablet, and doing like an individual, even if I don't fully, like, I'm not expecting to get anything like 100% rendered or something in a day. I don't have the time to do that,
right?
But to try to get something done that I feel proud enough of to put on social media and sort of track, you know. Where
I saw your one picture.
Yeah, there's two now, and I decided, like, I was like, I should probably put them in the same thread. That makes more sense. But so I'm doing that now, and it's already, like, it's felt good to just sit down and dedicate some time to do it again, you know. And so I've been drawing more recently. I've been, you know, I did the emotes and stuff for my my Twitch channel, and some stickers and things like that. So it's not that I haven't been drawing, I remember, like, when you and I first met, it was the only thing I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, you did that one painting of me with my cat, and it was, like, really, really good. Like, you were, that was, like, you when you were doing art all the time.
Yeah. And, I still have that somewhere. I have the canvas. It's not completed, but I have it. But, yeah, and I mean, I was the kid who was taking 3 hours, 4 hours, I can't remember if I was taking 3 or 4 hours of art my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I had was, my teacher in high school, my art teacher in high school, he was really, really talented, but he was really old school. And he did not understand, well, it's not that he understood. To him, your passion for art should be something that is for you. And he only saw, like, animation or cartoon or anime or even illustration that wasn't, like, trying to be Norman Rockwell. Anything like that is just a paycheck and not a passion. And so he really deterred people, and he would, like, count people down on scores and things like that. And it really kind of warped my interest, because I was like, well, if I'm doing this, I'm not actually an artist then. Like, I'm just trying to, like, shill for money. But at the time, yeah. I didn't even consider, like, doing art for money. But I wasn't allowed to do the kind of art that I wanted to do. And it really affected me a lot more than I thought it would or realized at the time.
And there's a lot of that in music too. Like, if you're not a starving artist, are you a real artist?
Yeah. And, or, you know, if you're not able to hit these notes, if you're not, you know, a if soprano, you're,
if you're not, a wedding singer, you're not a real musician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's all sorts of things like that in any kind of creative, I feel like, you know, if you're not a published by, you know, Random House, then you're not really an author. If you haven't won an award, you're not really an author. And when in reality, some of the most successful authors right now are coming from self-published groups on TikTok.
Look, like, I don't want to talk about that because that's how we get Stephanie Meyer.
I mean, and... Do we want
Fifty Shades Lady.
Yeah.
Like,
but...
Are we calling that literature?
You get a ton of other incredible authors, too. And so it's one of those things where I can see where I've watched countless, like, TikToks and things like that and videos from authors and stuff like that saying that, you know, or musicians, like, I was listening to a podcast and they talked about how Barbara Streisand was told at one of her early shows, like, in her life, on stage by a director, like, you're never gonna go anywhere. No one's ever gonna work with you. You're terrible. Like, you should just quit now and, like, find another job.
Yeah.
And it's like, Barbara Streisand, you know, like,
when people said Meryl Streep was too ugly to get work.
Oh yeah. I mean, it happens so often. And then you've got the counterbalance of people saying that Margot Robbie is too pretty. Like, mm-hmm. What? No,
she's mid.
You know?
She's mid.
Oh yeah, she's mid. Or that, yeah. And, like, I don't know. So it's felt really good getting back into drawing again and trying to do it consistently. Even if I'm just taking, you know, an hour or whatever before bed to get something down. Like, actually having to go through and think about what I want to do and what I want to draw and who I want to draw and how the pose and the colors and... You know, trying different techniques and things like that. It's felt really good. I've only been doing it 2 days, so we'll see.
Good.
Sorry, I guess I had a lot of feelings.
You did. Yeah, that was like, I talked about me for 2 minutes and then. Ooh, you got on a roll. Sorry. A roll with butter. Now I'm hungry.
That sounds good.
Yeah. I unbuttoned my pants at the beginning of this episode and I just said, oh yeah, a buttered roll sounds great. Oh man.
I ran to Walmart this morning and grabbed some Red Lobster Cheddar Bay biscuits on a whim since we have an oven again. And I was like, I can't wait to have those. Talking about butter biscuits reminded me that we had those in the freezer now. And I was like, oh, hell yeah.
Let me get through this so you can have your Has your muffin been buttered?
Do you like someone to butter your muffin?
Oh, man. Let's do this. Welcome to The Strange and Unusual, where we discuss the strange and unusual. This is episode 178 of our series, seeking out the weird, the unexplained, and the devious from around the world. I'm Casey.
And I'm Roya.
This week, we will celebrate the start of Black History Month by telling you about the mother of civil rights in California. As always, find us on social media. We are on X, Threads, Instagram, Facebook. Just search for our logo. And of course, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/strangeandusual. Join the party. We have a poll coming up at the end of this month for Roya to tell us a little something something. I don't know what won.
Right now, what is winning is She Wants Revenge.
All right. Well, you have until I think it's the 9th to vote. Maybe I did the 7th. Well, by the time you're hearing this, it should still be up for another 24 hours. So go and join us. It's just $2 a month. Vote in the poll. See what we come up with. So now, the episode. Wee woos. We got racism. Guess you're shocked by that.
I mean.
We're going to talk about a little bit of colorism as well. Definitely going to be talking about slavery, white people being white people. There is a mention of a racial slur or offensive term. I don't know. There were different, it's like a disparaging term, but it's not like the N-word, right? So yeah. Like, it's not appropriate. Don't fucking say it to anybody, but maybe not on the same level, right? I don't know, though. It's not my experience. There are vague mentions of sexual violence. Libel and defamation for sure, including accusations of murder.
Not murder.
Yeah. This episode will not start with my usual Sophia Petrillo opening because, well, Mary Ellen Pleasant was a bad bitch. She's also kind of an enigma. According to her own autobiography, Mary Ellen says that she was born, like freeborn, two freeborn parents, in Philadelphia on August 19th, 1814. But was she? Accounts differ on where and when she was born, whether or not she was born enslaved, and who her parents actually were. According to her own account, she said that her mother was a black woman from Louisiana and her father was a Kanaka. I'd never heard of that term, so I found a note from the American Heritage Dictionary saying, quote, "The word Kanaka simply means human being in the Hawaiian language." When borrowed into English, however, it was naturally used in referring not to people in general, but rather to Hawaiians or Polynesian ancestry, more broadly to any Polynesian person. Since this usage has often been perceived and has sometimes been intended as derogatory, Kanaka is best avoided by outsiders, but among native Hawaiians, it's often used today as a term of ethnic pride, especially in the form of Kanaka Maoli. I hope I said that right. It's a traditional Hawaiian ethnonym. Which can be translated as true human being or real person.
Okay.
So despite Mary Ellen telling us who her parents were, some sources say that she was actually born into slavery in Georgia or Virginia. There were people saying that her father was Cherokee, or maybe he was a white slaveholder and her mother was a voodoo queen, because of course. There were reports that she was born a slave somewhere between 1814 to 1817 in Georgia. One account even saying that she was born in Augusta, Georgia, in 1817 to a son of a Virginia governor and a Haitian slave. So, as you can already tell, we're just talking about where and when she was born. This story was kind of difficult to navigate the truth. And the truth is that researching women, and especially black women in history, is not as simple as researching men, especially white men.
Yeah.
She was such a successful and important woman. But because she was successful and important as a black woman, those in power, white people, did what they could to make her seem small and insignificant, spreading misinformation to demean and discredit the importance of her story in history. Dr. Lynn M. Hudson, author of, quote, The Making of Mammy Pleasant, a Black Entrepreneur in the 19th Century San Francisco, an associate professor of history at the University of Illinois, she suggests that she was born into slavery and claimed, if she was born into slavery and claimed she was born free, that might be her way of avoiding being captured and taking back into slavery. But being born free did not make you exempt from being enslaved, depending on where you are and the laws of the time. Though she did still mention, or like Mary Ellen maintained that she was freeborn even after slavery was abolished. So I don't know what she would get from that. But we at The Strange and Unusual will choose to believe the story Mary Ellen has told us about her life as she tells it, because we believe women here. Cool? I mean, generally.
Yeah.
Regardless of that, we do know that as a child, Mary Ellen ended up on everyone's favorite whaling island, Nantucket, around 1820, just a year after the departure of the Essex, for a fun little throwback. In her own words, she was taken there by her father, but she could not recall why she went there, and she couldn't recall any kind of life before that time. She was allegedly either a domestic or indentured servant to the Hussey Gardner family, who were Quakers and abolitionists, but Dr. Mildred Strange from the podcast History Lessons for Mythanthropes, she simply says that she went to be raised by Mrs. Mary Hussey, who Mary Ellen later called Grandma Hussey, but that she worked for her room and board. She didn't get any kind of formal education while she was there, but she was still around a lot of abolitionist sentiment. She's quoted as saying, quote, "I was a girl full of smartness who let books alone and studied men and women a good deal. I have always noticed that when I have something to say, people listen. They never go to sleep on me." And that family, they did teach her how to read and write. So on top of that, even though there was like segregation, they were free but segregated. She was around other free black people who were running businesses and creating their own industry, as well as women, widows of whalers, who were running their own successful businesses as well. So she worked in Mary Hussey's shop, and she's quoted in Agency, Married Women Traders of Nantucket, saying that, quote, "Mrs. Hussey in her shop sold everything from fish hooks to tons of coal. Buying wholesale and selling retail was the way she did it, and it paid. I was finally placed in the store as a clerk, and I could make change and talk to a dozen people all at once and never make a mistake. And I could remember all the accounts, and at the end of the day, she could put them down and they would always be right as I remembered them." And that was where she developed her business acumen, and likely why she later considered herself a, quote, "capitalist by profession." Which we don't love, but also, girl, get it. Like, you're a black woman in the 1800s. Do what you gotta do. Eventually, around the age of 20, she ends up in Boston as an apprentice to a tailor. Things like dressmaking were a great way for women to make money at the time. And especially in Boston, that was like a huge, industry there. There are some accounts that she went to Boston simply to find a husband, which sounds like something a man would say. And some sources went even further, claiming that she got to know the customers of the shop she worked in, saying, quote, "It was easy to learn who were the men of wealth, and there was one customer she watched particularly." Some accusations.
I mean, I could see that too.
Some accusations were saying that she married her brother because a black woman is clearly disgusting and would marry her brother because white people have never done incest ever, you know. We hate white people. Anyway, whether she was there for her husband or not, she did end up marrying an abolitionist man named James Smith, likely through other abolitionists or in those same circles. He was either white or mixed race. Historians don't agree on what kind of race he was, but he was very successful as a contractor or carpenter, and while he had money, I have my doubts that that was the only reason she married him. It may have been. If it was, I'm not worried about it. Again, get that bread, like, do what you gotta do, but I don't imagine that was the only reason. There were some sources that claimed he was a agent for an anti-slavery newspaper called The Liberator, and that Mary Ellen likely attended anti-slavery society meetings. There were suggestions that the couple were a part of the Underground Railroad, helping escaped enslaved peoples make it north to Nova Scotia to freedom, coordinating transportation through contacts in Nantucket and New Bedford, Massachusetts, as well as through Ohio and possibly Louisiana.
I just always think how, like, it's so funny whenever somebody is, like, shocked that, like, a black person or a mixed race person would have, you know, dared to have been against slavery.
How dare you? Shocking. You don't know how good you have it.
It's the same vein of people who are trying to convince us now that enslaved people liked it.
Oh yeah,
it gave them a purpose. What?
Yeah, they.
Let's not pay.
What else were they gonna do with their time? Well, unfortunately, this wasn't necessarily a happy marriage, and James did die only like 4 years later. However, Mary Ellen got quite the inheritance. There were conflicting numbers here. Some said $15,000, which is in 1850s money, would be equivalent to about like $500,000 today in the year of our Lord 2024. But if it was on the higher end where they speculate it was $50K, that would be more like $2 million.
Yeah, it was like $500,000. Okay, you could buy a pretty nice house.
$2 million. Haha! Get fucked. I'm Mary Ellen Pleasant, bitch. She returned to Nantucket for a short period where she eventually met John James Pleasant, and they married in 1847. Together, they had a daughter named Elizabeth. And, well, after the discovery of gold out west in 1848, the couple, like many others, left to find their fortune and maybe potentially just a little bit to escape reprisal for her abolitionist work. Just a touch. But they left Elizabeth behind with the Husey family while they established themselves, which is important later. Elizabeth unfortunately died in her 20s, so she did not make it very long. But Mary Ellen and her husband arrive in San Francisco, and she immediately starts raking it in. The general population was made up of about 8 or 10% women. So she worked as a live-in domestic, and there was even one source, I think it was a Napa Valley Register article that I read, it claimed that there were wealthy men who were like starting bidding wars to hire her as a cook. Her husband was also a cook on board a boat. So for most of their 30-year marriage, they weren't living together. They were not seeing a lot of each other. That is also important later. But this woman was brilliant. She invested her money and she invested it well. Some claim that she was only successful. I say only successful because that's how it was phrased. Because she made these investments based on the conversations of wealthy white men whom she overheard as she attended to them during meals and parties and whatever.
I mean,
I'm like, fucking so?
Yeah, maybe. You know, like, but she was still smart enough to capitalize on it.
For real. One of the big ones that I remember her investing in was Wells Fargo.
It's a big one.
Also the Bank of California. So much so that Wikipedia called her the co-founder of the Bank of California.
Wow.
She diversified her investments through property as well as precious metals like gold, silver, and even quicksilver or mercury. She opened restaurants, boarding houses, and laundries staffed mostly by Black individuals. Although, in the History for Misanthropes episode that I mentioned, it did say that she had like three laundries, and as the wave of Chinese immigration started becoming more prevalent, she sold them because that was a lot of what Chinese immigrants did at the time, was open laundries.
Yeah.
But it boils down to all of these services were needed by the idiot men who came out there alone and didn't know how to wash their own laundry or make themselves a sandwich. So she's just keep on keeping on out here, right? All this time, she's still working because, again, these men are useless and there were so many of them. She's making something like 10 times what a normal domestic servant in like New York would make.
Wow.
So she's investing all of her inheritance and then using the money that she gets from her job to just live because she can, because she's making that much money. But that wasn't all. So while California was a free union state, it was not necessarily a haven. The Compromise of 1850, which was meant to settle several issues connected to slavery and avert the threat of dissolution of the Union, it really worked. Haha. One of the five acts included was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which required that slaves be returned to their owners even if they were in a free state, and the federal government was made responsible for finding, returning, and trying these escaped slaves. Mary Ellen decided that she was going to become an abolitionist 501c3, and she put her money where her mouth was. She hired former slaves to work at her businesses. She continued helping with the Underground Railroad, funding things, and helping fugitive slaves with safe transportation, housing, finding jobs. She helped them establish their own businesses. She paid for legal help when attempts were made to extradite them out of California to return them to slavery. She, like, paid lawyers to try to help these people. She also helped women of any ethnicity who were on their own in San Francisco by providing housing, clothing, and helping them home children if they could no longer support them, like finding homes for the kids.
That's got to be a hard decision and job.
But this is why she's known today as the mother of civil rights in California.
Fair.
As usual, some accounts claim that she would use her knowledge of these wealthy men that she worked for, blackmailing them into marrying some of these women. That Napa Valley
couldn't be because they thought that the women were beautiful. Because
couldn't be that. No,
other races can also be beautiful.
Yeah, look, she potentially married a white or mixed race man. Like, it's not probably impossible.
She probably blackmailed him into marrying her.
That's clearly true. That's so true. How did you know? But that Napa Valley Register article that I mentioned earlier, it also says, quote, she also arranged liaisons between her beautiful white protégés and wealthy men, which led to marriages and greater financial stability for Pleasant. Her protégés and associates kept detailed records of the men's activities, information which Pleasant used for business, some say blackmail. That was from 1998. They're still talking shit in 1998.
Yeah. How dare she? How dare she be better than white men at their own game?
For real. In the late 1850s, she ended up in Chatham, Canada, a town that by the 1850s was being referred to as the Black Mecca of Canada because so many enslaved persons ended up there through the Underground Railroad. And she started supporting a little fella that you may know by the name of John Brown. Do we know John Brown?
Not familiar.
Strange that you don't know John Brown. He was a prominent leader in the American abolitionist movement, and like in the decades preceding the Civil War, Wikipedia called him a radical abolitionist, a leading exponent of violence in the American abolitionist movement. He was a part of Bloody Kansas. He killed like three dudes, and it says that he believed he was, quote, an instrument of God raised to strike the death blow to American slavery in, quote, sacred obligation. This is a white man who deserves his own episode. That's all I'm saying. But and he lost like five sons in his like abolitionist work trying to free fucking slaves before any of this Civil War shit started. So he orchestrated a raid that you may have heard of with the intent of initiating a slave revolt in the southern states by taking over the armory at Harper's Ferry in Virginia, which is now West Virginia. This was that guy.
Okay.
His intent was to arm rebellious slaves to strike terror into the slaveholders of Virginia, which is why you can find leftist gun groups calling themselves John Brown clubs, supporting the right to bear arms for their own protection, as well as to safeguard against state overreach. AKA, if the only people with guns are cops, how do we protect ourselves against cops?
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll see groups of people with guns like in front of pride events and things like that, and they act like a shield against protesters and say you're not the only one who is carrying a gun, basically. Yeah, it's basically like, we don't want a police state, so we support your Second Amendment right.
Yeah.
John Brown had originally asked Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass to join him at this raid at Harper's Ferry. Tubman couldn't make it. She got sick. And Douglass thought the plan was suicidal. Well, guess who helped him fund that mission? Our girl, Mary Ellen Pleasant, of course. What? She secretly donated like $30,000 to the cause, which was like $1 million today. $1.1 million.
Wow.
Unfortunately, as Douglass suspected, the 20-person raid failed and John Brown was caught and later executed. There was a note found in his pocket which read, "The axe is laid at the foot of the tree. When the first blow is struck, there will be more money to help." And it was signed with the initials MEP. However, you may be shocked to hear. It's very surprising news. She was likely never even suspected, since the initials were misread as WEP, and they almost certainly believed it was written by a wealthy northern man. She thought it was great that her shitty handwriting made the pigs go down the wrong trail, though. She was really tickled by that. She ended up back in California before the Civil War broke out in 1861, and she was right back to work. In 1866, she took part in a couple lawsuits against racial discrimination in San Francisco, specifically after she and two other black women were told to get off of a streetcar they were riding. Sound familiar?
Few times.
The case ended up in the California Supreme Court, and they ended up outlawing segregation on public transportation in San Francisco from this case.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. However, the Supreme Court did reverse the damages that she had been awarded in a lower court ruling, so she didn't see much out of that, other than the law was passed.
I mean, but it seems like,
throwing her money everywhere.
Yeah, well, she's big into investing and everything, and it doesn't hurt to have more money, especially when you're trying to fund big things like she's trying to do, not just within San Francisco, but within abolitionists and everything in general.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, her ultimate goal there was to get the law overturned or changed. Yep. It wasn't to get money. Money would have just been a nice side effect.
Yeah.
A bonus.
And then In the 1880s, she paid the legal fees for a white socialite named Sarah Althea Hill in the case against Senator William Sharon, accusing Sharon of abandoning her after marriage as well as adultery.
That he name claimed sounds familiar to me.
Which one?
Althea.
Sarah Althea Hill.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
She was a socialite. You might have heard her name in, I don't know, social circles. But the senator claimed that they had never married, but he was paying her $500 every month for sex. Mary Ellen was accused by Sharon's attorney and the press of having, quote, sinister intentions and manipulating Sarah Althea Hill to take this case to trial. They were trying to say that she was a madam and that Hill was one of her prostitutes that she was just trying to get more money out of. She was also accused of poisoning Sharon's food and practicing voodoo against him.
Of course they, she was.
Yeah, of course. They said,
clearly,
quote,
clearly the only way she's doing this is by dark powers.
Oh man, that's not even the worst. They accused her later of the only reason she was successful was because she was using voodoo on white men, and they were like crying that she cheated the system because she was using magic. She was not, by the way.
I mean, very much like the cone of power.
Yeah,
we can't say maybe she was. Wasn't. Yeah. But yeah. We're also not going to say, that's like saying the aliens definitely built the pyramids because,
yeah,
you know, ancient civilizations were not at all technologically advanced to stack rocks in the best way to stack rocks.
Yeah. couldn't be me. But yeah, so they were trying to say like, well, confiding one's secrets in a mammy was simply what well-brought up white ladies do. Like, this whole situation was garbage. And it also exposed the extent of her wealth, because I think people weren't aware that she was a wealthy woman because she was just playing this live-in servant, right? So they found out that she had 8 homes, a ranch, $10,000 in bonds, which is like $3 million today. Or sorry, $100,000 in bonds, which is $3 million. And, quote, a ready sum in our city banks.
Yeah, she's running the city, guys. She's running San Francisco at this point.
Yeah.
If she pulls her money out, the bank's just going to fold.
somebody did call. I can't remember where I read this, but yeah, they said that she was Black City Hall. Yeah. They called her that. Yeah. Sarah, by the way, who was only in her 20s at the time, and Mary Ellen, who was in her 70s, were even accused of being lesbians. Not that, you know, we have Holland Taylor and Sarah Paulson. Like, that's not out of the realm of possibility. But they're, what, 30 years apart? And these people are 50 years apart. I'm just saying it's not likely.
Yeah, it's not that it can't happen. It's that even by modern sensibilities, that would be unlikely.
Yeah. But yeah, everybody was just puzzled by the nature of this older Black woman wanting to help a younger white woman, as if Mary Ellen didn't just protect other people. Other minorities. Marginalized groups of people. Yeah. They claimed, like I said, they claimed she was a voodoo queen. That was why she got all this money. They said that she was a bad... Oh, this is... I said this was important later. They called her a bad wife and mother because her husband was away a lot and she was seen as an unfaithful woman living in homes with other men in these boarding houses. That she owned, yeah. And she was a bad mother because she left her child behind, as if that's new to the sensibilities of the world. People were doing that when they came out west.
Yeah.
All the time.
Who on what planet is it a good idea? They didn't know what they were going to.
Yep.
Like, and not just that, like how dangerous that trip is to get across the Rocky Mountains. That's not
easy to do.
We've
all played Oregon Trail, okay?
Like, I mean, it's, and that's not even taking into account food shortages, illnesses, weather differences, indigenous people being pissed, rightfully so. Wild animals that they've never seen before and don't know how to interact with. Because can you imagine, like, realistically, if you see a coyote just kind of looks like a dog. And it's
we've
not.
Seen enough white women on TikTok taking in coyotes.
Like because it's, you know, a coyote is so much smaller than a wolf. It's not as scary, but it can still fucking kill a kid.
Yeah,
and or startle the horses that have never seen this animal before, and then throw the kid out of the wagon. Like there is a ton of reasons to leave elderly and children back while they were trying to explore and figure out And it's not, you're talking about, like, situations in the U.S. where it's, like, Lonesome Dove, or, like, the show, you know, where it's, like, oh, yeah, this is rough living. This is no amenities. This is no, like,
there's fun no room stuff service here.
Like, there's nothing. Everything is having to be shipped out here. Everything, you don't have these conveniences of just being able to go, you know, down the street, down the block in New York City and get the things that you need, because they there's might no not be there for a month.
In San Francisco. Yeah.
Like, and so it totally makes sense. I wouldn't want, like, if I was living the time, I wouldn't even want to go to begin with as an adult. But then, like, on top of that, I surely would not want to take my children that I probably only have half surviving left of. And, you know, little Timmy probably just survived scarlet fever, and who knows what that trip will do to him.
Like... Yep. I've got cholera. Now I want to play Oregon Trail, though. That's something you should put on your stream.
I've never actually played Oregon Trail.
Are you kidding me? It's a rite of passage. Now you have to.
All right.
Cool. I'll be there for that one. You let me know when it's happening. Okay. Well, anyway, so back to Mary Ellen. There were actually some people who even accused her of being glad that her daughter died. I was like, cool. Is that the standard precedent of motherhood we're holding?
Well, and like, what precedent do you have to establish that? Like,
well, I mean, it was literally the wild, wild west of newspapers. Like, you could write whatever you fucking wanted. And somewhere along the line, I couldn't find exactly where in the story this started happening, but she did start being called Mammy, a name which she rightly loathed, and what I was saying at the top of the episode, right? So in case our listeners might not be aware, I don't know how many people are from the U.S., Mammy is a U.S. historical stereotype depicting Black women, usually enslaved, who do domestic work, including nursing children. I think Hattie McDaniel's character in Gone with the Wind was literally called Mammy.
Yeah, or the, you know, when we used to have the
Aunt Jemima, exactly, yep.
Maple syrup. There's another bottles. One, too.
I can't remember. It wasn't Uncle Ben's, but that's another one that's like another stereotype.
Yeah.
But anyway, the problem with it.
Cream of wheat.
Was it the cream of wheat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I knew there was another one.
It totally threw me off because I was so used to seeing that box, and I went to the store because Elise sent me to go get some. And I was like, I don't know where it is. I don't see the logo. I just kept looking past it because it's like a fully different box now. Yeah. And I just kept not seeing it.
Well, so the problem with this stereotype is that finding an actual mammy by description is was nearly impossible. The Jim Crow Museum website sources Patricia Turner, a professor of African American and African Studies, saying that before the Civil War, only the incredibly wealthy could afford to utilize, quote her words, utilize the Black women as house servants rather than as field hands. And that house servants, when they were coming from the slaves, were usually mixed race, skinny, because shocker, Black people were not given much food, and younger, because fewer than 10% of Black women lived beyond 50 years of age. And one terrible but true reality of slavery was that slave owners sexually exploited their female slaves, especially light-skinned ones who approximated the mainstream definition of female sexual attractiveness to a white man. This is an excerpt from that museum's website directly because there was no way for me to state this better. The Mammy caricature was deliberately constructed to suggest ugliness. Mammy was portrayed as a dark-skinned, often pitch black, person in society that regarded Black skin as ugly and tainted. She was obese, sometimes morbidly overweight. Moreover, she was often portrayed as old or at least middle-aged. The attempt was to desexualize Mammy. The implicit assumption was this: no reasonable white man would choose a fat, elderly Black woman instead of the idealized white woman. The Black Mammy was portrayed as lacking all sexual and sensual qualities. The de-eroticism of Mammy meant that the white wife, and by extension the white family, was safe.
Gross.
So yeah, and there were other contested facts that I didn't really get into in her story, one being that she was said to have very fair skin. That was never, that's like one of those things that some people said she was, some people said she wasn't, and some even said that she didn't start identifying as Black until the end of the war, but it's hard to say how much of that was true.
Well, but that's also, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, Yeah.
Like, it's the same thing of, like, my great grandmother never wanted to register anywhere as Native because of how badly the Indigenous people were treated in her lifetime. She was like, I don't know when they're going to round the next group up and ship them off. And take them.
Yep.
And I don't want that to happen to my kids.
Yeah.
Or my kids' kids, or whenever they decide to do it again, you know?
They try to portray this as her intentionally passing herself off as white to pull one over on everybody. And it was like, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. All I'm hearing is a bunch of white men who are really, really upset that a black woman won.
Did the thing, yeah. Either way, like I said, she hated the moniker. And according to the New York Times, she told the San Francisco Call, quote, I don't like to be called Mammy by everybody. Put that down. I am not Mammy to everybody in California. I got a letter from a minister in Sacramento. It was addressed to Mammy Pleasant. I wrote back to him on his own paper that my name was Mrs. Mary E. Pleasant. I wouldn't waste any of my paper on him.
Damn, get it.
Get it. All of this bad press really sullied her reputation, obviously, and she started on a financial decline. Mr. Pleasant had passed away in 1877, and in the last couple decades of her life, Mary Ellen lived in the mansion, in a mansion with her business partner, Thomas Bell, and his family, his wife and their children. After Thomas Bell died in 1892, his wife claimed that tens of thousands of dollars had been stolen by Mary Ellen and that her husband had been manipulated by her. Their assets were so intertwined that it was difficult to discern what belonged to who. At one point she even tries to say that Mary Ellen killed Thomas Bell. They like tried to suggest that she murdered him for the money. She did end up losing most of her estate, and though she still had investments, she was cash poor and so declared by the court to be unable to pay her debts. In fact, while I was looking for podcasts about her so I could listen to them at work while I was doing these notes, I found a podcast called Female Criminals, and they titled the episode Mary Ellen Pleasant, Millionaire Murderess. Like, so it's still being perpetuated today that she might have killed this guy. I didn't listen to it. I don't know what they actually say about her because I avoided that. I was like, this is almost certainly not true. So
yeah, it would be weird because she would have been how old at the time?
She was almost like she was in her 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say if she was or in maybe, her 70s in the 40s.
Yeah, her late 80s.
Yeah.
So yeah, or maybe her late 70s. I don't remember.
It's old.
I can't do math.
Old enough that I would disbelieve her ability to murder someone.
Murder somebody. Yeah. Well,
not necessarily impossible, because we have some granny killers out there, but like unlikely.
Yeah. And yeah, I meant her late 70s, because it would have been like if it was 1814 and 1892. Yeah, that would be like 78. But yeah.
Yeah, my grandma wasn't murdering anybody in her.
No, she'd be breaking a hip. But anyway, I don't know if that podcast. I'm not calling anybody out. I'm just saying I didn't listen to it because it sounded like bullshit to me. So
yeah,
you can listen for yourself and let me know. But she started a legal crusade to recover her property. She even had a diamond collection that had been lost in this lawsuit. But it was never settled by the time she died in 1901. Mary Ellen dictated her autobiography to the journalist Sam Davis. She says, quote, before I pass away, I wish to clear the identity of the party who's furnished John Brown with most of his money to start the fight at Harper's Ferry and who signed the letter found on him when he was arrested. And of course, there's some debate on the donation to John Brown, whether it didn't actually happen because there's no documentation that it happened, as if you would write down your illegal activities, you know, just for historians will know for sure that it happened. but there are some that say that it wasn't the amount of money she said it was, which was $30,000, like I said, $1.1 million today. But it was actually a collection taken up by the black folks in San Francisco, or, you know, and it wasn't nearly as much, you know, that sort of thing. However, when she died in 1904, it said that she wanted her grave to say she was a friend of John Brown. So I don't know why you would just lie like that in death. It seems like that's a good time to start being honest. But yeah, they didn't actually put that on her grave until 1965. So like 70 years later, she finally got it put on her gravestone. The mansion has since been demolished and was replaced by the Mary Ellen Pleasant Memorial Park. And in his 1924 book, The Gift of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois compared Pleasant to Harriet Tubman, saying, quote, "She was quite a different kind of woman, and yet strangely effective and influential. Here was a colored woman who became one of the shrewdest business minds of the state. She anticipated the development in oil. She was a trusted confidant of many of the California pioneers, such as Ralston, Mills, and Booth, and for years was a power in San Francisco affairs. Throughout a life that was perhaps more than unconventional, she treasured a bitter hatred for slavery and a certain contempt for white people." As she should.
I mean, they can't really blame her.
Yeah. And along these lines, there's some sentiment that the variation of her story in which she's born into slavery, that the black population of San Francisco sort of held on to this because it was so inspirational, believing that even as an enslaved person, you could break free and become successful and wealthy and a hero to your people.
Yeah, I'm actually watching this show. It's one of my like garbage TV shows, but it's about these black female entrepreneurs in Mississippi, in Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things that one of them talks about is how she wants, the reason why she didn't want to move her business out of like the hood, like the dangerous area of town, was because she could see young black women coming into her store and seeing her there as a business yeah. owner of a successful business and saying, she can do that, that means I can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And like that meant more to her than being in a area that was necessarily more affluent or could even help grow her business further. That interaction with people, like the people she came from, that this is the neighborhood she was from, and so it was always important to her to have her business in that area. And I was like, you know, it makes a lot of sense. It's like the same thing for me of like seeing representation of Middle Eastern or Persian characters in media that's not like a terrorist or negative yeah. or violent or anything, because for so long in my life it was so rare.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, with that, today we celebrate Mary Ellen Pleasant, a former slave, potentially, who became a millionaire. She was the inspiration for Michelle Clift's novel Free Enterprise, and tours of the city often refer to the corner of Octavia and Bush Streets, where her mansion once stood. That corner also begins one of the San Francisco ghost hunts, claiming that she haunts the place, which feels rather fitting. So if you go, just remember the words she once spoke, "I'd rather be a corpse than a coward."
What a badass.
What a badass bitch. I hope you enjoyed that.
I did.
I learned about this woman from a drunk history episode, which is how all good episodes of The Strange and Unusual by Casey usually begin. She was played by Lisa Bonet.
Ah.
Yep. Which makes sense because they were saying that she had been fair-skinned.
Yeah, particularly light-skinned.
Yeah. But yeah, that's that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's one of the things where it's so easy to kind of forget about the civil rights movement and abolitionists and stuff that weren't necessarily just in that, you know, Florida to
yeah.
New York line. And, you know, how many in through Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas there were too, and different things like that. And then obviously on the West Coast as things started coming up. But I just think it's a good story, I think, that needs to be talked about more. And I think it's a shame that this will probably be the first time that almost anyone that listens to this podcast will have ever heard of her.
I hope not. But yeah, she's not one that, you know, she's not the Harriet Tubman. Wow. Harriet Tubman. I read her name on my notes as I said it and brain mushed them together. She's not a Harriet Tubman, like, or a Sojourner Truth, like people that you taught in your elementary schools and things like that.
Well, and so many people are just taught the absolute bare bones basics of mm-hmm. any kind of civil rights or anything. You know, like the idea that Malcolm X was the crazy, like, dangerous, violent black leader, and MLK was the docile, peaceful black leader. And it's like, have you really, like, stopped and read Martin Luther King's, like, other yeah. speeches? Not I Have a Dream? The yeah. other ones? Where he's very much, like, on the by any means necessary bandwagon.
Like, and then we just don't talk about Bayard Rustin because he was gay and nobody wants to talk about him. Like, yeah. Man only just put together the March on Washington. Don't talk about him, though. Like, yeah, it's an important story to hear that there were more than just those like five or six people, including your John Browns, because white people didn't associate with John Brown. Like, there was a reason he was asking Tubman and Frederick Douglass to be there. It was because nobody else backed him. When he was in, AJ was telling me about him, he was in, he had been arrested and they had let him write letters and he was writing all of these newspapers and basically just, I don't want to say proselytizing, but like he was getting his word out there. And that was what made middle-class white folks in the North finally go, oh yeah, we should probably do something to help this. Like, they were not his friend.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, when you're running the opposition for the norm, you know,
yeah,
for what has become the standard, then of course you're going to be a pariah as yep, long as it takes for people to see you become a hero.
Yep. Oh God, is he Batman?
But he didn't live long enough to see himself become a villain. He kind of reversed
that. No, he was the villain. So I guess it's kind of like Harvey Dent. He was the villain who became a hero.
Yeah. But, it's one of those things where it's like how much just a little bit of research and educating yourself on things can change your view on what, like, I think so many people... our generation, I think, are kind of the ones who are trying to break it, like with the kids, the Gen, what is it, Alpha and whatever, where it's like, you know, not everything you learn in school is 100% the truth, and not everything, and you're not going to learn everything in school, and like,
well, you have, let me tell you, not everything you learn on Drunk History is true either. It was very different from the reality I found while researching.
Yeah.
It's almost like a drunk person was telling the story.
Yeah. But it's just interesting to see how much misinformation exists out there about any kind of culture that was seen as less than by the culture that won. Right. Quote unquote.
Right.
Won. Like, you know, how much misinformation there is. Like, this is just a Viking.
Yeah.
That Vikings were all just like these horrible raping monster machines. They were dirty and they're violent and they're going in and they were like establishing trade and not actually having as violent as anyone thinks they were. And super having clean. Like the only race or culture of people at the time to have a dedicated day of the week to go and take a bath. Like, not once a month, not once every 6 months, a weekly bath day.
Yep.
And it's just, it's so, there's so much, if you just open your eyes and you just do a little bit of research and you look into things and form your own opinion based on the information versus letting someone else form the opinion for you.
I think we're seeing that now a lot with the, like, Israel and Palestine situation, too.
That's what I was going to say. Of just like,
people were like, well, I want to support the Jews because they went through so much. And now we're like, well, maybe the Zionists don't have it right.
Yeah, it's like both sides can have been the victim. Like, that's
but that doesn't allow you to perpetuate violence because you were a victim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've been talking to my manager at work and updating her on the things that are changing and like what things are happening and sort of just pushing her to like, look, you need to have an opinion on this.
Yeah.
This is something that I like you. I want you to be on the right side of history on this.
Yes.
One.
Like, I'm trying to educate you. Allow me to do it.
And she is. And she's very hopeful and she's been signing the petitions and sending the emails and doing what she can and everything. But yeah, it's just, and it's one of those things where she had no idea until it started. And she was just like, why am I seeing this on NPR and everything? Like,
hold on. If she's an NPR bitch, she knew about this. Because that's where I was educated on all this shit happening to begin with, was me starting to listen to NPR.
Yeah, and that's where she started as well. And then she and but I this were was
years ago.
It.
I mean,
No, I think she's a newer.
Okay, I was like, I've been listening to NPR, and they talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict well before this started happening, and now
and there's also the difference between understanding that there's an Israel and Palestine conflict and what I'm trying to help her understand, or like what I've been talking to her about, is that like while Hamas is not necessarily 100% right, you can't hold a militant group that is trying to get out from under the boot of their oppressors. Like,
what were you the one I was talking to about that Disney Channel movie, The Color of Friendship?
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, like, I remember that movie.
And like the girl from South Africa was like, my dad's a part of the apartheid or whatever, and trying to explain like why it was fine. And like part of it is like the minute the knee comes off the back of the neck, what is the person underneath your boot supposed to do?
Yeah.
Just go, oh, sorry about that. That was a misunderstanding. We're cool. Like, no, you're going to fight back because you think, you know.
Yeah, are you going to just let someone hold you down
right
with a knee to your neck? No.
I'm not.
Like,
I'm going to kick that guy in the nut.
I mean, it was this whole, this is about to be a big diatribe for us, but.
Shocking.
No, so when I was in high school, it came up, the Israeli-Palestine conflict came up in a, like, conversation where we were supposed to be looking, it was English, and we were supposed to be, like, kind of dissecting this article written about it in the, is this a argumentative essay idea, right? Of, like, which side are they on, how are they doing it, blah, blah, blah. Right. And the teacher at the end sort of just asked how, if anybody had opinions or feelings or whatever about it. Me and the only other, like, Middle Eastern, West Asian person in my class lock eyes. Because we're both just like, we know what this is because our parents have been talking to us about this for years. Like, this has happened to where our parents are from before. And I remember explaining it to them as, like, let's say that there was a war that happened. Part of the situation was that the rest of the world just decided that this group of people are going to come and live in America. And by coming and living in America, Americans now have less rights or no rights by comparison to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And if that were to happen, are Americans going to just be like, okay, well, I guess that's fair? Absolutely the fuck not.
Nah.
We already have militias and it's not even like at a no rights level situation yet.
Yeah.
Like it's not great, but it's not Israel and Palestine right now, right?
Right.
And when I phrased it like that, I could see the whole class's opinion change. Of just like, yeah, no, we would all have, it would be the Civil War. Like, it would be the Revolutionary War again. We would have militias, we would have guerrilla fighters, we would have people coming out of the woodwork with all sorts of guns and weaponry and whatever they've had in order to restore what we had. And I was like, which is exactly what Palestine wants to do.
Yeah.
Because they let these people in thinking that it was going to work, that it was going to be okay, because they should have access to their religious land just like Christians and just like Muslims. And then it wasn't okay anymore.
Yeah.
It became very not okay very quickly.
Yeah. And like it's just the idea that it's Israel's fault that Hamas is what it is.
Oh yeah, it's 100%. Netanyahu was paying Hamas for decades.
Yep.
Like, anyway. Free Palestine.
Yeah. If we didn't say that yet this episode, so yeah, definitely free Palestine.
Hopefully they're talking about a ceasefire again, so hopefully. But then I saw the representatives are trying to push for another $17 billion fund release to Israel, and I'm like, where, you know, we are paying like fucking $4 for a dozen eggs.
Yeah. But we can't cancel student loan debt.
Yeah, that would be ridiculous. Student loan debt. We can't have, you know, we can't expand food stamps or assist in homelessness or, you know, any of these things. We can't ensure that kids get to have a meal at school if they don't have enough money to. Like, the fact that there's even a situation where any child has to pay for a school lunch.
Well,
like,
what did you
say?
17?
Should just be a thing. Like,
what did you say? 17 billion?
Yeah, that's what they were saying, I think.
Yeah, the like Department of like Urban Housing or whatever said it would cost 20 billion to like alleviate homelessness, but we're not going to do that. We're going to send Israel money instead. Yeah, the Department of Housing and Urban Development said it would cost $20 billion to end homelessness in the United States.
Yep, but why do that when you can have a war? Another war. Immediately after we just failed to have another war for the last 12 years.
Well, I'm depressed now. Wrap it up.
Where is my mouse? Well, that'll be a fun noise if it gets picked up on the...
I didn't hear anything.
Thanks for joining us today as we explore the story of the incredible Mary Ellen Pleasant. And now we want to hear from you. Send your stories, your questions, and your feedback to strangeunusualpodcast@gmail.com. If you're sending a story, we just ask that you put listener story in the subject line so you can sort through those a little more easily. Do you have any cool abolitionist stories in your family of, like, your, you know, great-grandparents and stuff doing cool shit? We'd love to hear about that.
Do you have a story about how you were in high school and went to a class and said things? We'll hear about that, too. Called out. Sorry. I'm trying to be nicer to you. I take it back.
Okay.
I take it back. You can also find us on Instagram and Threads at @strange_unusual_podcast or on our personal accounts, Roya Rampage and Calamity Casey. You can find us on X @_strangeunusual, @CalamityCasey, and @RoyaRampage. We're on Facebook. Just search for the Strange Unusual Podcast. And as always, Roya is doing Twitch stuff, twitch.tv/RoyaRampage and kick.com.
Yeah.
/RoyaRampage. So you can go check out her stuff over there. Like she said at the top of the episode, doing a lot of emotes and things. If you are into that kind of stuff, go there. Do the thing. I never use that stuff. I am the worst. I have like 50 bazillion points on your channel because I just, the sounds spook me. It's like I am overstimulated already. I get in there and I'm like, everything's scary. I'm talking to people I don't know. And again, as we said at the top of the episode, you can join us over on patreon.com/strangeunusual. Again, we have a pull up at the time of this recording. Like I said, I think it closes on the 9th. Yeah, so go check it out.
I looked it up.
I might not have even put an end date on it, but that's what I intended to. the poll for Roy's episode at the end of the month, it has some cool options on there. And it's only $2. You get episodes or previous bonus episodes that we had up there, some more us ranting about things, Roya ranting about Wonder Woman and how much she hated that movie. That was a good time. The James and Elena story is up there right now if you've been following our Lori Vallow content. But yeah, if you can't support us financially, we do understand, as Roya said, eggs are $4 a dozen right now. So just rate, review, share us with your friends, share us with your enemy, share us with your local abolitionist movement, and if you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read your review out loud, shout you out.
Yep.
You can even say something mean if you want to, just as long as it's 5 stars. Mm-hmm. Casey complains a lot about white people for being a white people. Let me say that again. Casey complains a lot about white people for being a white people. 5 stars.
I mean, like I was talking about, you're your own worst enemy.
What did you call me that one time? Well-seasoned?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a well-seasoned white person.
Yeah, you're not just like boiling chicken in water. Insane. I made chicken.
What did the, were you the one or did I send it to you? I can't remember. Somebody, I saw a white lady making guacamole on TikTok and she put olives in it.
I mean, I love, wait, green or black?
Green.
Ew, no, I could see black.
No, but that's not like a traditional guacamole.
No, it's not,
by any means.
But
what did she put? She put cucumber, olives, and shallots in her mashed avocado and called it guacamole.
No, I mean, I could, like, I put onions in my guacamole. I could see shallot. And I could see olives, but not
I don't think I
cucumbers.
Could. And no, not a chile in sight.
Or lime.
Oh, she did put cilantro in it. And she said something like, what was it? Because if you don't like cilantro, are you even eating guacamole? And then proceeds to add cucumbers and olives.
I could see using cucumbers to dip guacamole.
Yes.
But not in guacamole. Like, how would that even... Like, that would be the chunkiest
guacamole. She just diced it up really fine, yeah.
Ew.
Not a chile in sight.
Then you just have watery guacamole.
Yep.
Because all those cucumbers are just going to release the water as soon as you cut them up. Ew. No.
Yep.
Just because cucumber and avocado goes well on sushi doesn't mean that it goes in guacamole.
What was the one thing that Rachel Ray made that I remember everybody freaking out about? Was it elote?
Which one? Oh,
yeah,
she made
true.
The elote dip.
Yeah.
And then she's made pho. And then,
well, I know Uncle Roger's gotten on her ass.
And then she made, what was the other? She tried to make Birani one time. We saw that video and Elise and I were just horrified. Like, no, you don't, like, stop, just stop. If you want to do an ethnic food on your channel, on your show, great. Bring someone from that who culture
knows what the fuck they're doing
to come and help teach you how to do it.
Yeah.
Go find an up-and-coming, you know, YouTuber or chef or something. Help somebody get their career a jumpstart. Be super cool. And they can teach you how to actually make elote.
Yep.
Or how to actually make
pho
and not pho. I thought Elise was going to claw her eyes out. So we saw that at a laundromat so that we couldn't like turn it off or something. Cause it was the big TV. And we had our headphones, so we put them on, but we just kept the whole time.
We're making pho. That sounds like Rachel Ray. Her EVOO.
Yeah. It's just like, ugh, no.
There's two things I know about white
people. No, it wasn't Rachel Ray that did the pho. It was Ree Drummond. That's who it was.
Oh, okay. No, just as bad.
Yeah. And Ree Drummond with the Birani, too, I'm pretty sure.
Ugh.
But, yeah. Like, bring someone on your show. Show a little diversity.
No, I'm on a ranch, bitch. The only diversity I have is my cowhands.
There's not even biodiversity on this ranch.
Nope. There's no biome diversity either. All of our poops are the same. I made a poop joke.
What a way to end the episode.
Bye.